Welcome to Terragrams. Hi, I'm Craig Verzone, and I'll be your host for the 21st delivery of Terragrams. In this dispatch, we are joined by Ken Smith. Ken is a registered landscape architect and founder of the Ken Smith Workshop in Manhattan, as well as Irvine, California. He graduated from Iowa State University and the Harvard Graduate School of Design and practiced with the office of Peter Walker and then in collaboration with Martha Schwartz and David Meyer. Since 1992, though, he's been piloting his own studio while also teaching at Harvard, the University of Pennsylvania, University of Virginia, and the City College of New York. His professional work encompasses a broad array of scales and project typologies, and in his own words, explores the symbolic content and expressive power of landscape as an art form. He's well known for his camouflage roof garden for the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan, and his current work for the Orange County Great Park in Irvine, California. Terragrams is happy to welcome Ken Smith. Ken, thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and welcome to Terragrams.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by asking you about your most, your competition win of 2006 for the Orange County Great Park. Could you describe to us what the primary components of the park are and what stage you are in the process of construction or conceptualization of the project?
Okay. Well, the project is a kind of David versus Goliath project, and nobody ever expected that my team would win.
Are you guys David or Goliath?
we're definitely David because we were competing against much better established firms, bigger firms, and but we were also, I think, hungrier and really focused on the project in a way that we understood it perhaps differently, and that was, I think, instrumental. Also, I think our project, our proposal was more risk-taking. I think the notion of digging a canyon was, you know, probably a stupid idea, but it really worked, you know, and it was, I remember thinking about the risk involved in that and saying, well, yes, yeah, I have to do this, you know, because it's the kind of thing within the body of the theory of the practice of landscape architecture in the United States to create a false ecology of that scale is something that nobody would do. But it did make sense and it did resonate and it was successful. But the project, we won the project in January of 06 after a protracted selection process.
How many, was it an invited competition? Or
it was an invited competition, there was 40 primarily landscape firms invited, and
it's a big invite.
It was a big invite. It was pretty heavily based on the groundswell exhibit, and our submission, I think, was pretty good. We worked hard on it, so we got shortlisted, one of seven or eight, I don't recall now. Nobody thought that we had a chance. I remember, and you'll edit this out. I remember we went to the overview. And George Hargraves, you know, said, "So Ken, what are you going to do? Plastic rocks?"
So you don't think that they took you seriously?
Oh, I think the client.
No, but everyone else who ruled you out.
No, I don't. No, I don't think they did. I don't think they thought I had a chance in hell.
There's not enough fun in 130,000 acres.
Right. But the proposal was perhaps the one that was most different from all the others, and the presentation and the strategy of the presentation was fundamentally different than all the others. In this conference that we've been involved today, when Gary Hildebrand is talking about the presentation for Downs View and how it influenced the Staten Island landfill project. I remember paying attention to those competitions, and And for the landfill, I was at a municipal art society panel debate, and I was introducing Mark Rios's team, and I had to kind of understand his team and look at the other projects and stuff. And it was interesting seeing how they put their ideas forth and what worked. Mm-hmm. And so I was paying a lot of attention to the mechanics of how you present the idea and what works. And the other thing that I realized in reading the brief, looking at who the jury was that the professional jury was not going to make the final decision. They were making an evaluation, not even a recommendation. They were making an evaluation. And in fact, it was the board of politicians and elected, appointed people who made the final decision. Mm-hmm. So it was very clear to me that this competition was going to be decided in the realm of public opinion. And in the end...
For the people, by the people.
Yes. But in the end, our proposal got the highest marks among the professional jury. But it really did appeal to people.
So much for rational logic.
So much of that. But it did appeal to people. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple things that were done in a pushing of the rules. The rules called for a plan at 1 inch equals 50 feet.
Mm. Which is enormously big.
No, it's enormously small.
Small.
No, it wasn't. I'm sorry. It was 1 inch equals 200. Or one, right. one inch equals 500. Right. 1 inch equals
not
500.
Much detail.
It was basically a diagram at this scale, kind of reduced it down to, 20 by 30 or something. And I always work big. I like working big, probably because I have bad eyesight. I always blow everything right big. Because also blowing stuff up big forces you to deal with the mm-hmm. detail, and it actually poses questions and makes mm-hmm. you solve stuff that, mm-hmm. And I suppose that could be argued as good or bad, but
right.
it's
depending on what stage.
Sort of the way I do it, and so there was a 1 inch to 500 diagram, but I took the four panels and I arrayed them as one very large plan at 1 inch equals 100. So, and of course, it was quite detailed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could see every parking stall. You could see individual trees. You could stand up to it if you were, somebody who was interested, like from the public, and you could imagine yourself in this park.
Right.
And nobody else's scheme had that. Everybody else had the Photoshop images.
Right.
But those are also kind of generic at this point. You stand and you see the same soccer team that somebody, cribbed off stuck on a grass field with some trees in the background. Right. And it's like, okay, But we went in with this big plan, and with a great deal of detail, and
I noticed the big plan is still
the big plan is still
a big thing.
It's still a big thing. And then the other thing was that I knew everybody was going to do Photoshop images, and I'm very good at Photoshop, but I was trying to figure out how to distinguish the project, and I hired a comic book artist. Japanese manga comic book artist. From New York. A kid who just came out of the School of Visual Arts and was a, comic book artist mm-hmm. in Brooklyn, And she, we took a, basically took, did a manual Photoshop, or took the source stuff and scotch taped it together and said, this is kind of the view. And then she took it and then made a cartoon out of it, comic book image, and then scripted a narrative, which was also discussed at the conference today, and how narratives rule. Constructed a narrative of a day in the park, so that basically it would personalize it with people. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the cartoons people loved because they hadn't seen it before, we just had great legs, and then, but still we proved ourselves that we could do the project and got the project. So that's, you know, 3 years ago now.
And tell me, would you say we? Who else was on?
Well, the core team was Enrique Norton and Mary Miss and Stephen Handel and Bureau Happel for Sustainability Engineering and Mia Lehrer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the initial group. And Enrique Norton was very busy. And so Enrique was playing the role of critic during the jury, which was actually during actually putting the competition together. And that was actually pretty interesting because when you're doing the competition, you're so close to it that you have no critical distance. And I remember Enrique came in. He had a couple really brilliant ideas. He had a brilliant idea for the architecture. Once the canyon had emerged, he came in, and he said the canyon. He looked at it, he said, "That's a very good idea." and the other thing I remember.
And did he slip in the?
Then he cut in the buildings. Yeah. He said the buildings should be cut into the landscape, and that was a very powerful idea. And I remember I was kind of going through what we're working on, and I had, you know, mock-ups of the presentation boards and stuff around, and he was looking at it, and he said, "You know, Ken, I think you could win this." And I remember thinking that, you know, well, I'm the David, you know, and up against all these big firms, and, you know, I'm not going to win this, but I'm going to, you know, go
just
for
show,
it.
Show them.
I'm going to, you know, play with the big ones. And it was like the first time I kind of went, wow, you know, maybe we could win this. And so today we've done we had a small contract for critical issues to kind of get some very short-term things squared away, some infrastructure and boundary issues that were very critical. That because in the competition, you know, certain things don't line up. There's certain critical things that really have to get put in place, or it doesn't work. And so we did that in the first 3 months, and then we did master plan that took you know, about a year. And right now we're we're working on 97% schematic design documents.
Wow.
So we're pretty far along. And of course, concurrent with all of that, we've been building the preview park. So we've been doing.
So your CD, you've already done a set of CDs.
We've done two sets of CDs. We did a set of CDs for the initial part of the preview park, which was 2 summers ago, which was when the balloon went in, the berm, and the basic infrastructure, and then. For last summer, we did a second set of improvements, and right now we're working on construction documents for the third set of improvements to the preview park.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's interesting because it's not the way you would normally do a project. You would, you know, the normal top-down project is you would design the whole thing and then you would execute it in a very kind of rational, you know, big scale way.
Or at least bite off pieces, but you
design
the
whole piece. Right. And this isn't working that way. And I think it's interesting because it's basically using the preview park to create a constituency that will support the park to actually then enable the park to be built.
You also get to test some ideas.
We get to test the ideas, prototype things. And so while we're doing schematic design, we're actually building pieces of it. So we've actually are actually building benches that we're proposing for permanent design standards.
So you do CDs after you get the prototype.
Well, yeah, sort of. We're advancing that little piece, and we're designing that little piece, and it's, you know, happening. And right now we're designing the shade ramadas that are a permanent design feature, but they're going to get installed next summer. And so we're actually it's helping refine the design vocabulary, a kind of emphasis on wood, which is problematic and troublesome to public officials, and gravel, which is also problematic and difficult for the public officials. But we're able to do these things in the preview park because everybody understands it's a prototype and it's a preview park, and we understand that just because we build it in the preview park doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to get approval to do it as part of the large project. Of course, we all hope we will, And there are some things we'll probably learn where we'll decide, well, actually, that wasn't a good idea, and we won't do that. You know?
And how long has the preview park been open to the public?
A year and a half. This is the second full summer, mm-hmm. and this is the first summer that had active programming. The first summer, I mean, we just barely got the balloon operational.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very seat of the pants, which is the scale of the project, kind of amazing. But this summer, the first summer went in and the budget was very tight, and I did things in a very improvised manner with the scaffolding and stuff. Mm-hmm. And people loved the balloon, but they didn't like the creature comfort, and they didn't like the sort of the kind of the detail of the stuff. And so the second part of the preview park, you know, has allowed us to actually then get another level of detailing up, mm-hmm. and introduce things like the lily pad picnic pods with pervious paving, and these little wood boardwalk bridges, mm-hmm. and a bioswale, mm-hmm. Which was enormously difficult to pull off. You have no idea how hard it is to do a bioswale, you know.
What were the complications?
There are legal and code impediments to bad drainage. Mm. Basically all the codes and everything about water is legislated to move it as quickly as possible and getting it out of the way. And to try to slow it down and to get it to percolate is hugely difficult, because you're challenging a whole set of legal structures.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end of the day, I had to put a drain at the bottom of my bioswale.
How high could you set the drain above the
It's set at the bottom of the bioswale.
So you make enough bioswale so that the hopes...
Well, I'm hoping that eventually it will clog up.
Is it a single drain?
It's a single drain, yeah. But, you know, it was very frustrating. But, you know, I had a choice. I could accept a drain at the bottom of my bioswale, which made absolutely no sense, or I could give up the bioswale.
Right. And how effective do you think the bioswale is with the drain sitting down there?
It's partially effective, actually, because it's soiled. It's got enough length on it that the water has to move a quarter mile before it ever gets to the drain. Mm-hmm. And so there, and then with the thickened vegetation that we've planted, mm-hmm. I mean, we will get some infiltration,
right.
But it won't actually detain anything for mm-hmm. any period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're working through the design guidelines for the first phase of kind of real construction, and we're working through a process with the city to get alternate design standards established. Because right now, the situation we have is that we are governed by the City of Irvine, and the City of Irvine has defined standards for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a site plan in, and they have a checklist, and if you don't comply with all the given standards, you don't get approval.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going through a process of creating alternate design standards, which...
So do you have to rezone the site?
No.
Or can you put an overlay?
There'll be an overlay. And actually, the city's very good. They know what we're doing. They know why we're doing it. They understand mm-hmm. why. Although it's not easy, because mm-hmm. we're challenging a lot of stuff that they've done for a long
time.
Because
they know there are going to be three or four projects right behind.
Well, these are permanent.
You
know, the argument is that we have 50 miles of trails. That's enough trails that, you know, if we want to do some kind of special header or special paving, there's an economy of scale which makes it viable.
Right.
We're going to be installing enough benches that we certainly can design a bench that's particular to this park,
mm-hmm.
and we have enough light fixtures, enough of all that stuff.
Because the regulations dictate the typology, the type of bench and light fixture.
Oh yeah.
So you can't like come in with something that's not on their list.
No. No.
And you're interested in working on those.
Yeah. So we're right now we're going through the process of developing the alternate, and they have to be approved by several city commissions and the city council. And so, the first part is to do conceptual drawings, and the conceptual drawings are very detailed. Like, you know, on the light poles, we actually have to prove that the footings are sufficient, and we have to prove, and you have to, you know, they want life cycle costs on the.
So the conceptual drawings are pretty
The conceptual drawings are basically design development documents, right. So they're very detailed. And it's a very long haul, but it's crucially important because mm-hmm. otherwise it would be a normative
right.
part. And I think we'll prevail on most of it. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, we won't get everything.
You have a pretty special topographic plan, strategy. And there's one point in your project where you have these parallel canyons or earth berms mm-hmm. and you cut them to create a window into the big landscape mm-hmm. beyond. And there's another place where you have the where the balloon takes off, this mm-hmm. circular like donut,
right.
topographic donut. What it makes me think of is the project in Aspen at the Aspen Institute, and also that in a way the double negative.
I was thinking of Michael Heiser. I mean the picture window is a right. complete Michael Heiser kind right. of thing.
Well, what's and you have a real rich connection to the history of contemporary art and art as it exited the gallery into the landscape.
Yeah.
How do you relate your project relative to some of those original icons that we're still referring back to?
Well,
now?
I mean, there is a certain kind of appropriation of mm-hmm. that stuff, but there's also a kind of rootedness to Linote, you know, and kind of an understanding of eye levels and perspective, like the berm around the balloon is set at 12 feet, which is basically the height of the gondola. Mm-hmm. And so from the outside, you don't see the gondola. You only see the balloon rising above this thing. Mm-hmm. And when you get in the gondola to go up, you can't see the landscape beyond because the berm is above
right.
your eye horizon. And as the balloon goes up, there's a moment when you break above the berm when the entire landscape opens up, mm-hmm. and it's quite remarkable.
And I mean, you've already detached from the
yeah, you're,
ground
you're,
zero.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You're up in the air. You and the whole thing opens up. So there is a moment of surprise. Mm-hmm. That's all based on kind of understanding of sight lines, which is a very old thing. You know, to, mm-hmm. to construct big sections of sight lines and kind of understand cones of visions and things. And of course, those picture window cuts are also a kind of cone of vision, and they occur at strategic points along the preservation of the existing runway. Mm-hmm. They kind of frame a terminus point or some moment, mm-hmm. and they have a 60-degree cone of vision, and you know they're set up optically to work in a certain way to help you understand a connection with something mm-hmm. beyond. And
do you think these types of manipulations with these big land movements help to bring your park to one of its original narratives about making a park for the people, setting up these situations where an individual can get a greater understanding to its bigger context?
I think so. I mean, I don't want to over prescribe that. I mean, the worst thing in the world would be to do something where it's so didactic that, you know, people say, well, okay, I'm learning this, I'm going to take it home and do that, you mm-hmm. know. You want to set it up so people discover things. And mm-hmm. in fact, much of the park is set up in a way that things don't connect exactly and something takes you somewhere and you end up going to something you didn't expect to, mm-hmm. the kind of the surprises. But the earthwork, you know, the site was so flat and mm. so barren. To introduce the kind of large-scale earthwork really works. And there were these bunkers on site, the munition bunkers. Mm. And the munition bunkers were, the big ones were of the height scale of our berms, about 30 feet. And there was something very beautiful about them. They were quite architectonic. But there was something very beautiful about them in when you looked at them and you saw them in relation with the foothills and the mountains beyond, there was a very kind of beautiful scaling up to that distant landscape. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of understood that scale was correct, that there mm-hmm. was something about the 30-foot datum that made sense. And I guess the proof will be in when it's done, but mm-hmm. I do think it will work. And I spent time looking at other earthworks. I spent time going to areas around Southern California, looking at road cuts and things mm-hmm. that are of similar scale, to start to understand what that datum met and sort of how it felt. So I think in the end the scale is correct, although it's not as big as a natural feature,
right.
Because it's just not as big as a natural feature. It couldn't be, but I think relative to the scale of the park, it's the good scale. It's the right scale.
Now, you've argued this before, but for our listeners, could you argue it again? How do you justify, because we need to justify big moves like this, how do you justify the moving of such an enormous amount of earth for just a public park?
Yes. I was worried about that, and there are a couple justifications. There's a kind of a real justification, and there's a kind of technical justification. The technical justification is actually relatively easy, and that is that what we're doing is kind of in the scale of earthworks that happen in terms of roadway infrastructure and even golf courses, just in terms of cubic yardage. When they build these big stupid golf courses, I mean, they move huge amounts of earth, and so the scale of the earthwork is actually not problematic. And so that could be answered, but the other question is sort of the why was kind of more fundamentally based in the experience of going to the site and spending time in the heat of the summer and just baking, and you know, the it was brutal. I mean, the site is it's really a miserable, I mean, it's awesome, the beauty of it is incredible, but it's brutal. And so the canyon and what did this for me was the day before the competition briefing, I went to Balboa Park in San Diego, which I had never been to. And of course, I knew about. And I was wandering around Balboa Park, and I stumbled into this little palm canyon there. And it was not very big, but it was filled with palms. And it was a hot day, and I started down the stairs, and you could feel the temperature change. And it made quite an impact on me, because it was very palpable. And then there was a point in the design process when we were working through the stream corridors in the site, and I was having a discussion with Stephen Handel, the ecologist, and Stephen was talking about the need to have redundancy in the ecosystem and needing to connect things together so that there was multiplicity. And he was saying, well, you really need to connect this corridor to that corridor. And there was a kind of moment when this canyon just kind of came out, that was the solution. And sort of the memory of going into this thing, it just happened very quickly. Then there were a series of sections done and things, but it is this notion of kind of this large scale microclimate that's big enough that when it's planted and shaped, it will create a large area that is substantially climatically different. That,
how long is the area you're talking about?
It's about 2 miles, and it's 200 feet wide, and you know it's 70 feet of elevation, and it will fundamentally change that part of the park. So it will be comfortable, it will be cool, it will be shady, and it will be a respite. It will be a place that you can go and get away.
You're listening to Terragrams, and our guest is Ken Smith. Ken is a registered landscape architect, the founder of the Ken Smith Workshop, and the designer of the Camouflage Roof Garden on the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan.
While we're on the topic of scales of operation, the scale of this operation has led you to open an office on the West Coast as well as on the East Coast.
Yeah, well, actually, I was forced to open an office. I didn't want to. I never wanted to have more than one office. I would love to have run the project from New York, but it wasn't possible. The client wouldn't allow it, and so I opened an office from scratch, which was hugely difficult. I didn't bring any staff out from New York. We created a completely Californian office with Californians, you know, we hired from
How
scratch.
How many do you have?
Oh, right now there's, I think we're close to 12. For my staff, and Mia Lehrer has four or so, and then there's, you know, 30 engineers, and there's, you know, 20 project managers, and there's an ecologist, and, you know, some planners, and so the design studio is an agglomeration is maybe 60 people. So, wow. You know, it's a kind of a medium-sized firm.
And this is on the West Coast. Is your team on the East Coast? Do they work on other projects?
Yeah, the New York office has projects that are completely separate. New York is really specialized in a kind of medium-scale project, and the West Coast is a single-purpose office.
Do any of them long to go west?
No, I don't think so. I don't. No, there might be some people in the West who would like to come east, but no.
And tell us how your New York office operates, and a little bit of what you're working on now.
Well, New York has very little hierarchy, because the office has never really had a lot of hierarchy. I work on every project because it's my office, and
what you like to do.
That's what I like to do, and most of the staff are project managers in New York. More than half of the staff are project managers, and so each project manager will be managing one or two projects. Mm-hmm. And so they attend the regular meetings and keep up with the routine correspondence and kind of, you know, keep things moving forward. And then there's a smaller pool of people with less experience who kind of float around and do production work, you know, on the projects. But we're working on two projects in India, which are very interesting. One is an office building, and I'm doing the podium landscape. This is with Harry Cobb. It's quite a beautiful building. And then we're also working on the design of a 400-acre township, which is being designed for up to 80,000 people.
Wow.
And so
in India.
In India, in Hyderabad. And so we were involved
with the same team?
Same team, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's with Pei Cobfried and Bureau Happold, and so the first phase we worked on the master plan, which was basically the allotment of the sites and organization of the streets and the drainage ways and the Central Parkway and the kind of a waterfront on a dry lake. And now we've done design guideline documents on the streetscapes, and we're halfway through schematic design on the green fingers, which are the drainage ways, but they're drainage ways plus social space. Mm-hmm. They're occupiable drainage ways. And
what's the density of the houses?
Hugely dense. The low buildings are 4 and 5 stories, and the housing towers are 20 stories. Mm-hmm. And so it's an immensely dense development, and most of the housing blocks are of a scale that they have interior court, because the architecture is all about a kind of porosity in terms of movement of air and also provision of shade. Mm-hmm. And the Indian typical Indian residence has a certain outdoor aspect, and there's also the extended family, so that the housing units are actually quite large and complicated, and there's certain certain kind of, you know, cultural requirements in terms of, you know, how things fit together, and so it's a very interesting project. And then we have corporate work.
Wait, before you jump onto the corporate work, in a project like this, how I assume that you were asked to participate at the beginning of the design phase.
Yeah.
How did the general site plan evolve from the kernel of the layout of the densities and where the center was and where these green fingers were to get placed? What was your role in that whole process?
Well, we all went to India.
Good idea.
Good idea. Actually, I went to my first trip to India. I went for 2 days to see the first site, the office block site, And while I was there, I went to see this other site, the 400-acre site. And then when that project became real, there was actually not any design work done in advance. There was a certain amount of base map preparation and stuff. But we all went to India, all the the whole team. And Doshi is the associate architect. You know, the famous Doshi is working on the project, which is really, really quite amazing. And so, so we've spent first day on site, and the first evening at dinner, Doshi and Harry Cobb had this kind of big debate, and there was a napkin sketch that came out of that. A cloth napkin.
Was it like a 4-inch by 4-inch?
No, cloth napkin, dinner napkin.
An uncloth.
Uncloth, yeah. There's a real cloth napkin sketch that they came out of it, which, because it was a very difficult site in terms of the access perimeters and the dry lake, and there were a series of inholding of properties that were not part of the project. Mm-hmm. And Harry and Doshi, set forth this kind of arc that negotiated its way between these outlier properties, and that became the kind of central core. That happened that evening. The next morning, we met, and I did a series of sketches following the arc, where I suggested a central spine, where instead of a single single street, there were two streets, mm-hmm. and a big space in between that was a central green area. And because of the topography, I suggested a series of green fingers that, mm-hmm. that then tied the thing together. And that was quickly adopted into the scheme. And then
a new napkin was laid up.
Well, now we're working on tracing paper, and then pretty quickly went into the computers and things. But and then there was a period of several weeks where we were blocks and, you know, looking at setbacks and all the tech, and, you know, a lot of work kind of working through that stuff. And then the next two meetings were held in London because it was halfway between, you know, India and New York, and it was easier for everyone. And then the project, actually the first meeting in London was interesting because there was a kind of philosophical debate between New York and India about the character of the open space. Doshi felt that the central spine should really be like the Charminar or a kind of souk, a kind of marketplace. Mm-hmm. And the New York team felt that the central spine really should be more green and leisure. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge debate. In the end, our client is an American company, and the project is for the emerging middle class in India, and there's a great marketing appeal of American type projects. So in the end, the central green space prevailed. We've had huge fights about the green fingers. We've had just hand-to-hand combat with the engineers about the design of the green fingers. Mm-hmm. The local engineers have held steadfastly that the green fingers have to be a single purpose concrete ditch, and we've argued that no, they have to be a multi-purpose space that's both drainage way and mm-hmm. social space, and they should be rockery and permeable.
That's pretty profound though.
That's a pretty profound. And we've been
how wide are the fingers?
The small one is 24 meters and the big one's 50 meters.
So they're pretty substantial.
There's enough space for social life
and the housing backs onto them.
Backs are
four stories of
420. Yeah. Right. So I mean, there's enough space, and we've had this horrible argument, and the engineers have really dug in, and they've said that the green fingers, the drainage way has gotten fatter and bigger than we really want. I think they're like 8 meters wide currently, which is, you know, pretty wide space. And the engineers have,
because they're not collecting the roof water, they're just collecting.
Well, we are the, our
or
site.
Is it our drainage channel that's coming through the site.
Our site is at the low end of the watershed, mm-hmm. and so we do have water coming from mm-hmm. off site. Plus, we have all the water that will be generated from our site, and because it's an urbanizing area, there will be an increase in impervious paving and increase in runoff, and so and from off-site as well. So I mean, it's a serious proposition. Right. But most recently, there was an argument that to do rockeries would increase the rock channel from 8 meters to 16 meters, which is just ridiculous. And so, I mean, it's just we had these biweekly teleconference calls, and they're just excruciating, you know, arguing about the green fingers. It's just so fundamental. And
so is this the kind of project that you can still have fun on?
Well, except for the excruciating meetings arguing about green fingers, but no, it's an interesting project.
What are the fun pieces that you get to add or that make it
just the fact that it is what it is, and thinking about designing basically a town and understanding the interesting architectural ideas that the different architectural blocks that are designed by different architects in terms of dealing with the climate of shade and porosity and air movement. I mean, it's a very interesting project because it's a project that really is about ideas, and how all these ideas fit together is you know, it's a pretty cool thing.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of our conversation, you give us the impression that you're a young and inexperienced office, and you're not at all inexperienced. You have a terribly long history of experience in the practice, starting with Peter Walker and then your collaboration with Martha Schwartz. But you're still, after 15 years of having your own workshop, you're still considering yourself a young office. Is there a real viability for young offices?
Well, I hope so. I made it 15 years, so I think I'm probably going to survive. But I don't operate like a corporate office. Mm-hmm. I mean, to this day, I don't really have sufficient overhead and administrative structure, and the office is really a dump. You know, it's really a workshop. It was an old printing sweatshop. One thing I did was raise the fluorescent lights up, you know, so we could clear our heads when we walked underneath them. But I mean, it's not very fancy, and it's very unpretentious. You know, we kind of take the projects we want, and I kind of see it as not the corporate model. And so,
and do you think that the profession, that there are openings in the profession for young small offices to actually make it, or do you think in fact it's really hard in the North American?
I think
there aren't that many competitions, and when they are, they're open to big populations of architects.
Yeah, but I started doing ideas competitions, and I mean, I built the office from nothing. You know, I opened the office in 1992. I had been practicing in California in Peter Walker and Martha Schwartz's office, and I moved to New York, and I didn't have any work, and I didn't really have any social or cultural connections with the design community, and I opened up an office, you know, with a part-time teaching job at City College. And so, you know, the first 5 years were, you know, tough. I didn't make any money, you know. I basically supported it with the teaching income. And at some point, for tax purposes, you have to show a profit, or the IRS considers you a hobby business. And so at some point, I was showing a profit on the books, even though I wasn't making a profit. And I was paying taxes on, you know, profit I never really made, just because I had to show it as a viable business. But there was a point, I guess, you know, around year 8 or 9. I mean, it grew slowly, you know, and it started with things like the Glowing Topiary Gardens, which was on the face of it not a very fabulous project, but it was a great project. Or the Malcolm X Plaza, you know, basically I took small projects that weren't very promising and made them into something that was interesting. Reputation grew, and then you get better projects. And so, I mean, I think that's how it probably works for everyone. I can't imagine you just kind of launch into completeness. I don't know. Maybe it's possible.
And so, as a small office trying to set out the framework of a critical practice, clearly you had mentioned this earlier, in our discussion beforehand, or actually in your presentation, that small practice really needs to search out a typology of work and needs to clarify the methodologies they use to make their work. And then sort of hopefully with the good combination and some luck, you right. were able get, to get some something more. Built.
Yeah. Yeah. But part of it is finding out people who you want to work with, and actually teaching was good because I met young architects who were also opening their offices at the same time, and so there were collaborations that came out of that, which mm-hmm. were good. And for me, the critical distinction was that I was doing urban landscape. And so, I mean, I was really focused on the issues of densely built urban areas like New York City. And in the teaching, I was using teaching as a kind of research for interstitial spaces, leftover spaces, the kind of really problematic things that, you know, are difficult as hell to figure out what to do with because they're so torn apart or so scattered or broken up. And then the other thing was that the working method, it's probably evolved a bit, but in the early days, the working method was very opportunistic. It was strategically a bottom-up approach. This is really borrowed from the art world. It was not a top-down, rational, you know, it wasn't based on the way EDA would do it, you know, understanding the problem and mapping out, and, you know, it wasn't deductive in that way at all. It was a completely inductive process of taking what was at hand and kind of imagine what you could do out of that circumstance. And so there's a kind of a basic vocabulary that was developed over the years of dealing with things very opportunistically that now are used on larger projects that are more deductive because, mm-hmm. you know, at a certain scale of project, you can't operate inductively all the time. Right. And so at a certain point, you know, on a deductive project, you do figure out kind of strategic things, but the vocabulary and approach that was developed in those early years is very useful in terms of then how individual problems are solved. Mm-hmm.
You're originally from Iowa.
Yeah.
You grew up on a farm.
Yeah.
You had the opportunity to take over the farm, but chose to go to university.
Well, no, I didn't really have an opportunity to take over the farm. When my parents decided, probably when I was, you know, a month old, that I was going to go to college. And so there was no choice. You
Did
know?
You ever think about farming growing up?
No, I didn't
or
really.
Think about being a farmer?
Well.
Your father was a farmer.
My father was a farmer, but, you know, it was immensely difficult for my parents economically. My father had a job in town, and my mother had to work because the farm wasn't economically viable.
What kind of a farm was it?
It was a small family farm of corn and soybeans and a mm-hmm. couple cows, and mm-hmm. you know, it was a very difficult time for the American farm, and yeah. And basically, it was very clear that there was no future on the farm. You know, that we were going to be leaving, going elsewhere, and you know, farm work is also it's really hard work, yeah. and you know, I raised cows and, you know, raised the garden, and that was all nice, but in the end it was not my future. And mm-hmm. so
do you think back about those landscapes, and can you imagine that they have influenced the way you think about the landscape as you conceptualize it?
Yeah, well, there's a certain geometry that comes from the farm. I mean, I really love things in rows. I mean, just that's very innate for me. And there's a certain way that geometry goes over landform that I understand from the farm. But there's also the way that an abandoned field goes through a kind of primary succession that I understand kind of innately because, you know, I've seen that happen. Right. Yeah, those things you do take with you. Right.
You did your studies at Iowa State mm-hmm. in landscape architecture. Mm-hmm. And then after university,
I worked for 5 years at the Iowa Conservation Commission mm-hmm. doing state park and recreation mm-hmm. planning.
And then went to Massachusetts.
Then I went to Harvard, yeah.
And you worked for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in
part-time. Harvard. Part-time when I was in school. That was right. my job. Because I paid my way through mm-hmm. school. I was the first person in my family that ever went to graduate school. Yeah. You know, nobody, you know, had ever even talked about graduate school. And for mm-hmm. some reason, I decided I was going to go to graduate school, and I was working, and I figured, well, I'm an adult. This is my choice. And so I never even asked my parents for money. I just assumed that it was my, you know, my deal. And so I paid off my school loans from my undergraduate school, and I lived in basement apartments and saved money, and had, you know, part-time work when I was in school and was frugal, and just paid my way through.
Wow,
so
that's great.
It's kind of stupid, but
but it worked.
But it worked, yeah. Yeah. I made it through.
But from the outside, when I look at the work that I have seen of yours published, I don't see the work of in landscape architect practicing through an environmental agency. I see the work of an artist. When and at what point in your studies or in your thinking about the landscape did you become interested and passionate about the world of art?
Oh, I wanted to be an artist since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I wanted to be, and, mm-hmm. and I loved architecture. And when I went to undergraduate school, I discovered landscape architecture. I didn't know anything about it. I'd never heard of it, but I discovered it as an undergraduate, and so that was my major. And
maybe a marriage of farming and art.
Yeah, you know, it was between architecture and art, and of course that was the time of the environmental movement, the first environmental movement of the early 70s, mm-hmm. late 60s, and so then when I started practicing on my own, the little projects in the urban areas were really much more about social space, and mm-hmm. so I mean those projects, and I actually have a pretty good understanding of social space and sort of understanding of Holly White's research and, mm-hmm. and all of that. But as the projects have gotten larger, the environmental issues have become a stronger part of it. In Santa Fe, the issues of water, or certainly the Great Park, you know, has larger mm-hmm. environmental issues, or the project in India and the drainage waste. So mm-hmm. that's really, I think, a function of scale.
And do they help push some of these other ideas that might be more based in the art of the landscape?
I don't know. I mean, probably. I mean, a certain kind of approach to understanding of grading and things that I've developed over time that now come to fore in doing these larger things, like the grading of the canyon and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, the cuts and the slopes and how the things are constructed. There's kind of spatial things that I guess I've internalized over time that, you know, now are operating at a larger scale. But mm-hmm. it wasn't like it was a conscious strategy that I'm going to do this and then that. It's mm-hmm. sort of, I guess it's still kind of opportunistic in the end, you know, but I'm working in a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump to the really small scale.
Yeah.
You're working on a pro bono project. It's a public garden in Queens.
It's in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Bushwick. In Bushwick. I'm thinking about the
PS19.
The playground
is in Queens, yeah.
Which was a... You
that was pro bono also.
And a catalyst to this this project in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You just showed some photos of some of the vine structures that are going up. How has that project evolved, and are you having fun working at this smaller scale?
I love the small scale.
It's 0.13 acres.
It's a mosquito. I've always, even when I was doing smaller things, I always liked having a range of scales to work on. I mean, the scales are more dramatic now. There are things you can do at the little scale that you can't do at the big scale, and vice versa. So mm-hmm. the little scale project is also the craft of how you make something at the little scale is really important. Mm-hmm. And on that project, I first did three alternate, I kind of knocked out three fast alternative approaches so we could have an initial meeting with the neighbors who garden there. The client liked one a lot. The neighbors liked a different one, and then there were kind of aspects of the three that I liked, but in the end, the parts that I liked when I started developing it based on the scheme that the neighbors liked, it didn't work. And so I threw all three of those away, mm-hmm. and I came up with a new approach within the matter of like 2 days, after kind of, you know, thinking about it for like 6 months. the vine screens, and we very quickly built a model and showed it to the client, and they loved it, and they had a donor who thought it was great, and then we met with the neighbors and they liked it, and so
wow.
And then we even though it's pro bono and it's tiny, we treat it like a real project. I mean, there's a a project manager on the project. We've done complete construction documents, mm-hmm. completely detailed with specifications and the whole thing. Guy Nordenson is the engineer pro bono on the project, and Langen is the pro bono civil engineer. You know, it's like a really high powered team for this little tiny thing.
Pocket park.
This little pocket park, and but seeing it being built now. You can tell. I mean, the quality of the structures, the engineering, the structures mm-hmm. is really quite fabulous. Although it's off the shelf, you know, fencing mm-hmm. stuff. But the geometries were complicated because of the torquing and the twisting, mm-hmm. And it helped having a really good engineer mm-hmm. Work through it with me. Mm-hmm. And it's all been fabricated off-site. The fabricator made a template, a metal template that came and sat on the site. And then that template informed where the threaded rods went for the footings. And so it's all been set up according to this template. And now the pieces have come, and they sit, and they fit together.
Yeah, that's good.
And it's kind of amazing. We did a mock-up of two units first, and it went well. There was a little bit of adjustment, but there was adjustment of the system to make it work. And now it's, you know, moving along.
And in the end, it's a vegetable garden with some fruit trees.
It's a vegetable garden with fruit trees.
Small social space for...
And a lot of herbs. There's a huge amount of flagstone that's made out of recycled concrete, mm-hmm. and all the joints are planted with herbs. So, mm-hmm. there's mint and thyme and oregano mm-hmm. and all that stuff. So, other than the vines and the screen, everything is edible. And then there's also some cables overhead, which will have grapes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And will you plant this fall?
Parts of it will get planted this fall. I don't know if it'll all, I mean, we're going into October. In New York, we can probably plant actually into earlier mid-December. So in all likelihood, it will mostly all get planted this fall. The grand opening is scheduled for spring, so there's enough time so that the neighbors can actually get some vegetables planted and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of get it going.
Mm-hmm.
And we're keeping some of the old chairs. They had these ratty chairs that they kind of found on the street. I mean, because a community garden is traditionally not a designed thing. I mean,
right.
this is overly designed thing. And traditionally, it's as you can. You know, you get a board you find on the street, and you get another one, and you make a frame, and you know it's all done really on the cheap. Mm-hmm. And so. There was this really motley collection of found chairs mm-hmm. that were in the garden, and I thought that we really should keep them mm-hmm. because you don't really want to lose the memory of what the place right. once was.
And the way those are theirs.
Yes.
The neighbors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And have you had good feedback? Have they been part of the? Have they been watching the construction?
Well, everybody's been watching it because I mean it's so big. I mean it's like. It's not like anything else in the neighborhood. You walk down the street and you go, oh my God, what the hell is that? So you can't miss it. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation, not from our group of neighbors, but other neighbors. Some there was speculation that the city was building a swimming pool there. And I think our neighbors kind of look at it. I don't know. I think they'll be happy to get their fruit trees and their garden plots.
Right.
And, you know, I think the rest of it is probably just some weird stuff. But
that I suspect they'll grow in, sort of grow into and cherish.
I think so. I mean, right now, in the beginning, it's actually quite... I mean, it's a lovely structure because it's quite transparent. Mm-hmm. You know, formally, it's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not heavy-handed. You see through it. But over time, when it gets completely covered with vines, it's going to be an incredibly different space.
Yeah.
I mean, it really will be a contained place, and it'll be really green,
right.
and there'll be these folds and spaces, and it will be a beautiful place.
There
there's a place for picnicking, and there's a little nook where the cabinet goes for the tools, and there's a rain barrel so we can collect water from the roof next mm-hmm. door, and there's some benches and a bird bath, and there's some wooden poles that have vines on them,
mm-hmm.
and then there's some other little seats that are built in here and there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's all the stuff that you really want to have, the
right.
barbecue and the old chairs. And
oh, well, we look forward to seeing this. Talk to us a little bit about the relationship between the music of John Cage and cloud photographs.
Well, you know, I didn't have a proper cultural education. It's like growing up on the farm, you know, I didn't really study art, you know. And so when I was in college, I'm kind of self-taught in many ways. I would go to the library, and the library is quite generous because you could look up something and you could go up to the stacks and mm-hmm. you could discover all the other similar books, related subjects nearby. And I was not interested in old art. I was not interested in the Renaissance mm-hmm. and medieval. And
so history starts at around the 60s.
It's 20th century, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was actually working backwards. So in art, I was interested in Klaus Oldenburg and Rauschenberg. And when I was reading about Rauschenberg, I was learning about Merce Cunningham and John Cage. And then I was checking out music from the library, and I was listening to John Cage. And, you know, I was listening to John Cage and Stravinsky before I ever listened to Mozart, which is kind of backwards. But I always said I was lucky because I grew up on the farm, and because I didn't have a proper cultural education, I was never hobbled with good taste. And so
you have smaller pieces of luggage.
Yes, smaller pieces of luggage. So, but I was really attracted to the ideas of serialism and the ideas of John Cage, and I've thought about them for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so I did a project at Cornerstones mm-hmm. in California, a piece with the artificial flowers, where I first tested out this idea of indeterminacy with the placement of plants. In this case, it was on a wall, and there was a 12-inch grid and this notion of the module, which appealed to me because it's a kind of modernist organizing mm-hmm. thing, the raster. But working against that, each module had a choice of positions, of center, one of four corners, or one of four sides, so nine positions. And so we had a bowl of numbers one through nine, and mm-hmm. then we had a bowl of cards that had said tulip or hyacinth or, you know, mm-hmm. Boxwooders, and then we had these artificial plants. And so we did this wall at Cornerstones, working through this methodology. So it's part John Cage, but it's also kind of Saul LeWitt of a kind of prescriptive formula to execute something that is different each time you execute it. And I was interested in this because the problem with, you know, the geometric landscape is pretty clear, but maybe it's an overstatement. There's still a lot of things you can do with geometry, but there are certain understandable rules. And then in the what I would call the informal landscape of kind of, you know, in a derogatory way, you know, imitating nature kind mm-hmm. of thing, is very problematic because how do you figure out the order for that stuff? And mm-hmm. so this idea of using the indeterminate process was appealing to me because it set up a methodology which removed personal choice mm-hmm. from the execution. And in fact, these pieces, I did one at Cornerstones. I did another one at Ohio State University, and I did one at mm-hmm. Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum, and it's interesting the kind of mosaic that it produces that kind of hovers between inorganic and geometry, or organic and mm-hmm. geometry. And so the idea in the Great Park was to now take it to another level and actually use it for larger scale organizational space in the bosque to actually organize a grove of trees, or in the parking lots to organize the open spaces where the trees come out of the parking stalls. So we're working through that mm-hmm. process now.
That sounds super, super interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
And fun.
Yeah.
I'll wrap up with this last question. You've just attended the Biennale of Landscape here in Barcelona, and you've had a chance to see the 11 final projects and actually meet many of their mm-hmm. authors. What are your thoughts relative to the selections, and what if we could use those selections as a cross-section of the atmosphere of landscape architecture or public space making in Europe. What are your thoughts about what's happening?
Well, they were interesting. The presentations were interesting, and the projects were interesting. The presentations were very much couched in a poetics of the author, which I don't find so much in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think
well, in spite of your own personal poetry.
Yeah, but I don't wear that on my sleeve. I think Georges Decombe said that the Americans are much more forthright and practical in the presentation of the ideas, and I think the Europeans were more poetic in terms of how they presented the ideas, which I found very interesting and actually compelling, and the projects there's a crispness to I think all the work. Which is interesting, and kind of a lack of maybe messiness. I don't know why that is, but the range of the works, from the schoolyard to a kind of infrastructural wall to a factory, I was kind of blown away by the factory, because in the United States, landscape architects, I don't know anyone who's ever worked on a factory. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we even build factories in the United States. And so I thought that was interesting. Many of the projects worked with issues of water. The whole aspect of waterfronts was very prevalent in many of the projects, dealing with creating a new stream alongside an existing canal, or dealing with the floodplain in the Oxbow of a river, or creating a new lake as a swimming lagoon, or that was a very common thing. That and probably it's really just one of the things that landscape architects do, is dealing with the edges of streams and waterfronts. Is kind of inherent in our work, and I think probably in the United States, the work on waterfronts is also a prevailing concern. So I mean that's clearly a real commonality, I think, between Europe and the United States.
And on the horizon of Ken Smith and his workshop?
Well, we have projects under construction. The Goldman Sachs World Headquarters is under construction. I'm working with Pete Udolf, and Pete is fabulous to work with. Pete was quoted, New York Times reporter asked Pete his definition of a well-composed garden. And Pete replied that a well-composed garden is a garden that decomposes well. I thought that was just the most brilliant thing I've ever heard. I mean, just really beautiful and succinct. And he's been really a lot of fun to work with. I mean, it's been a very, very good collaboration. And the East River waterfront is, parts of that are in construction documents, so that's moving forward. We're doing some weird things. I'm designing a dog run, and I'm designing an enclosure fence made out of dog chains, which is kind of wacky. And
the dogs will get it.
The dogs will get it. Yeah, well, actually, I'm not sure. The whole idea of taking the instrument of dog control and then using it to control them, I don't know if they'll actually, you know.
They may get it, but
they may not like it, yes. So.
Well, we look forward to seeing more of your work, and I could sort of continue peppering you with questions, but I know your time is valuable. Thank you so much for joining us on Terragrams, and best of luck in your new horizons.
Good, thank you.
Ken Smith is a registered landscape architect and the founder of Ken Smith Workshop. Thank you for joining us for the 21st Dispatch of Terragrams. Join us soon for conversations with Alexander Reford, founder and director of the Reford Gardens and Métisse International Garden Festival, as well as a conversation with Berlin-based landscape architect Gabriela Kiefer, finalist for the 5th Biennale of Landscape. To find out more about Terragrams and sign up for our next deliveries, please visit our website at www.terragrams.com or subscribe to us using iTunes. Special thanks to the books for the wonderful and very cool music, You can expose yourself more to the books at www.thebooksmusic.com. This concludes our 21st delivery of paragraphs.
Without a job, without a salary, I was trying to get unemployment, and I was told it first kicks in after a few weeks, and I was busy looking for another job, and I also have a heart condition, and I told him I have a heart condition. I said, here, take a few dollars. I'm sorry this happened to you, but just leave me alone. I'm not the person who deposited those money.
Myself, April, Tammy, and Brad.